Hello, and welcome to the Grand Cinema Hotel, a podcast hosted by two friends who love cinema. Tonight, you'll be staying in room 180, Bottle Rocket, the feature film debut by Wes Anderson. So go ahead, get comfortable, and throw on that Do Not Disturb sign as we kick off our celebration of an acclaimed filmmaker with Bottle Rocket.
Criticisms.
I have only one. Not very thorough. Left a lot of valuable.
Yeah, I don't think that was
No, I don't know.
Driver, what's our ETA?
7:30.
Good. We're on schedule.
Practice job, heist, and the idea that you and I both respond to goals, and it all leads to Mr. Hendrick.
Oh, the guy from the letters.
Exactly.
Oh, that's right. You're on that top secret mission. I'm sorry. I forgot I was supposed to say anything.
You know, Jonathan, the world needs dreamers.
Excuse me?
Halfway crooks, and thank you for checking back in. My name is Gus, and as always, I'm joined by Alvaro.
What's up, guys?
And before we get started, make sure you like and subscribe, as it helps the channel a long way. Back after 2 weeks, back with a project. This is the first time we've done something like this. We promised this a little earlier in the summer, but it's finally here. I've been calling it, in my own head, I haven't told this to you yet, but the Wes Anderthon.
That's good.
You know, the filmography of Wes Anderson from beginning to end. And, you know, we had to start in the beginning.
Of course.
This is a movie I haven't seen, and I don't think you'd seen it either, right?
No, I hadn't seen it.
Was this your only blind spot in the Wes Anderson filmography?
No, I haven't.
Still need to see a few.
I haven't seen Rushmore.
Rushmore. Have you seen Darjeeling Limited?
I remember I've seen it one time. I don't remember. And then I think one time you were watching it, and you showed me some parts of it, but I don't... I feel like that's one I am excited to revisit.
I almost bought the Criterion of that today because I was at Barnes & Noble and I saw they had that one, and that was one they kind of stuck out to me. It's kind of one of my like low-key favorite ones. I feel like it's a little underrated, honestly.
Yeah, I was gonna say is from what I've seen from it, I think it's some of my favorite stuff from him, but I can't really decide on it because I don't really feel like I have a current like thought process on it.
Yeah, so I mean, this is good because you're getting these out of the way one right after another, so you'll see Bottle Rocket next, and then you'll have completed the filmography, the Pokemon badge. You can put it in your case, you know, like I've seen them all. Bottle Rocket, I mean, what a shocking thing to watch, right? As opposed to the other 10-11 films, I think it is.
Yeah, I it does really feel like there's a lot of the foundation set here, but I think because we're that age too, we have to retrospectively watch it. Mm-hmm. So it is very interesting perspective to start from because you know it's a director that we've kind of grown up with, but it is before this not predictable, but this style that kind of gets made fun of or ripped off is really executed. But if you're watching it after seeing so much of his work, you do see signs of the stuff that later ends up becoming more prevalent, or I should say better well done, or a budget that makes it to be better well done.
One of the reviews, I did quite a bit of research about this film because I feel like the other films I have gone back and, you know, I've watched videos, read reviews at the time. Wes Anderson is just the kind of filmmaker where I, you know, in my free time will just like, I don't know, I want to find an interview with him or see what people have to say about him who will look a little deeper than just the style, you know, like what do people actually have to say about Wes Anderson who look past just the visual flair and things like that. Roger Ebert, one of his reviews was that this movie, it's almost like you can't judge it for what it is. Or what it's not, you have to judge it for what it is, which is at the end of the day, it's young kids who are friends with a tiny budget making a movie with what they have in front of them. And I do think that is very prevalent on the screen. And this also becomes something that is less prevalent as the films go on. I mean, whether Rushmore was a $5 million film, and I believe Grand Budapest is a $25 million film. And just that small budget increase I guess it's an astronomical increase between Bottle Rocket and Rushmore.
Yeah.
And that's why it's like, okay, you can really see the vision here. And not to say that he needs money to do what he does, because like you said, there is a lot of stuff in here where you're like, oh, okay, this is like the blueprint for what's to come, right? But he's also a very young man at this time, so I'm not surprised that he doesn't have fully fledged ideas and how to pull these things off, right? It's like,
yeah,
not correct. Everyone is going to make the perfect first movie, you know? It's like, that's pretty crazy to make a Hereditary or a The Witch or a Get Out, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is what this movie is. It's what's in front of you. And I think it's one of those movies that during this time where directors were preaching about, you know, video being accessible and go out there and just shoot. I think this is the type of thing the director's kind of meant about just shooting what's in front of you and being able to make a movie.
And, you know, he's not really considered part of this group, but he is of the age of the Quentin Tarantinos, the Paul Thomas Andersons, the David O. Russells, you know, the Jim Jarmusches, like guys who really pushed that renaissance of these young rebels who just grab a camera and make a movie, right? And I think maybe because of everything after, like Wes Anderson doesn't retroactively get thought of as one of those guys.
Exactly.
But, you know, I'll get to this a little later, but he is one of those kids who grew up just like Steven Spielberg with his dad's Super 8 making silent movies of his friends and his family. So I just think that the difference here, though, is that as opposed to something like Hereditary or The Witch, this is so obviously a first film, and I would find this more comparable to something that like Kevin Smith would make.
That's what I was going to say. Clerks.
Like a Clerks, yeah. Or a Mallrats or something like that, where it's like, I do think that this is an enjoyable film with a lot to take, but I also do think it's a mess. It gets a little lost here and there, but I don't know, you know, just because we really like filmmakers who make banger first movies doesn't mean that I am unforgiving to somebody who hasn't fully figured it out yet, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, some of the best directors that we've talked about in this podcast that we revere, their first film wasn't their best film, and or even remotely to being this high tier film like we had with Jordan Peele, or like you said, you know, Hereditary or The Witch. So those are anomalies. And, you know, a lot of the older directors, they had to flesh out. And, you know, it even kind of happened with Cronenberg. You know, like his first movie is very limited to scale, like you said, very what's in front of them. And I think it had a lot to do because they kind of, this, you know, the studio system, the movies, they were very set on using, you know, old directors and not really giving kids a chance. So I feel like they had to really establish and make those movies. But, you know, Bottle Rocket is a short movie, and it just feels like they asked them to make the longer short movie.
Yeah, so I wanted to get to that in a bit, the short film itself. I haven't watched it. I don't know if it's available on YouTube, but I was thinking at some point throughout the project that I would try to have seen all of his short films, because he has made quite a few. I think there's about 5 or 6 of them where they're either commercials that are like 15 minutes long, Bottle Rocket's 13 minutes long. You know, I know he has one that's like a prequel to the Darjeeling Limited. So there's a lot there to dig into, right? But for now, I kind of wanted to just focus on Bottle Rocket. But, you know, the original one was shot in 92, the short film, and it's shown in 1994 Sundance, where it's picked up by James L. Brooks, right? Legendary producer, The Simpsons and Tracy Ullman Show and many other things like that. He saw something in Luke Wilson, which I think is funny. He compared him to his screen presence being similar to legendary actor Montgomery Clift, right? So I don't know if Luke Wilson has really ever thought of like that, but honestly, in his work with Wes Anderson, so this movie and Royal Tenenbaums, like I can see where there's like that lingering kind of, I don't know, something that like Jeremy Allen White or Austin Butler or Timothy Chalamet would try to pull off today. You know, it's almost like a James Dean thing. I feel like that's an easy way to pinpoint what I'm talking about. It's like this brooding, kind of lost, depressed young man, you know.
He has a look for it too. So
yeah, I do think that he gives a good performance in this movie. I'll say that. He's not necessarily my favorite actor or anything like that, but I don't think I've ever really been like just disappointed when I've seen him in a movie.
I mean, there's the interesting aspect in this movie that all three brothers are in this movie, correct? Yeah. And again, really plays into what's in front of you. But I do think that in favor of like what works for you when you have to do that is that obviously these three brothers and Wes Anderson themselves are pretty close, so that it does feel like the performances that they're giving is because they all understand that this how serious they actually want to do this. It does feel like it's like a group dream, and so it did feel like this was all executed and they themselves really wanted to bring their A game to their performances, because like you said, not my favorite, but I do think they all this like the performances and the characters that they wrote out for the script is what I think carries this movie.
Yeah, and you know who else felt kind of the same way was actor James Caan, who's in this movie. He, I was watching a local news channel in Dallas do a report on the movie when it first came out in 1996, you know, and they're like, local stars, Wes Anderson, Owen Wilson, Luke Wilson, like this local Dallas trio. And it's like, James Caan sees a lot in them too. And he was like, you know, these are some young guys who have good heads on their shoulders and seem like they're having fun. And I like their attitude about how they are, how seriously they're taking this, making a movie. So I'm sure there was other reasons why, you know, mortgages are due, things like that.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Why he was probably in this movie. But I think even, you know, James L. Brooks and James Caan and also producer Polly Platt, who is also very well known, kind of seeing the vision early, you know. And then when this movie comes out, one of its biggest supporters is good old Martin Scorsese. We talk about him all the time. This is one of his favorite films of the 90s. This might be the first time I disagree with him on his opinion, right? I don't know if this is one of my top 10 favorite films of the 90s, but I do think it does encapsulate a vibe that you don't see in movies that are probably past like 2005, honestly. Like, it just has something about it where it's, like, it's so crystallized a time that I remember, you know what I mean? Of like, I remember when people dressed like that. I remember when people looked like that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's kind exactly.
We're talking about almost 30 years ago now.
It is interesting because it does come off as one of the words that he gets used to get, like, described a lot. And sometimes it's, like, a lazy word. But, like, this movie is still quirky. You know what I mean? The whole essence of the movie is, like you said, there's this, like, I would say this like testing of reality, where this movie, in what scope does it sit in a regular type of rich environment, right? Like the kind of kids that they are. It does feel like in the era, this is something that there's movies now that I've seen, maybe The Worst Person in the World comes to mind, where someone like the character here, Luke Wilson's character, kind of has a more serious derivative in the story, and this becomes kind of a movie that's kind of made more now about, you know, self-reflection and stuff. But then this movie at a time that it was made instead kind of just takes it as almost like the fact that this condition would only exist in the kind of world that they live in, and it wasn't really as mainstream. Does that make any sense?
A rich kid malaise, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
my life sucks.
He's right?
He's going through mental breakdowns over jet skiing or water skiing or whatever.
Mixed anxieties and he just got sad. You know what I mean?
Suburban anxiety.
And I just think at the time, you know, those movies of suburban anxiety. We're not complete experts, but I don't really think before this era, the 90s, it's something that was really, I'm sure there was films made on it, but it didn't really feel like they were films that are really, like, people really resonate with.
I mean, honestly,
much.
the great film about suburban anxiety is Rebel Without a Cause, right?
Yeah.
And I do think that this movie is, you know, Rebel Without a Cause is one of those movies that is so influential that it's like DNA is spread in movies that have nothing to do with it, like in terms of similarity, like the tone of the film or whatever,
right?
But it's like you always have to think about like young people with the suburban angst, feeling lost, kind of I guess ungrateful is one word to use, right? Of like their situation that they're in, everything sucks, you know, or like, oh, I'm just so depressed because I don't want to talk about jet skiing anymore.
Or it's like you know, Taxi Driver, you know, something. It's like, and that's obviously to a not a teenage angst, it's a more of a like a taxi driver in New York, but I do think because you brought him up, like Martin Scorsese can identify that this is a world of a very specific type of demographic, and those always make for the most interesting stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I did want to talk about Wes Anderson in general. I thought a fun thing to do during this time, too, would be to kind of check in on Wes Anderson and where he was in his life. Maybe try to find what some of his inspirations are. And honestly, in doing research for this episode, it makes sense. Like, you could say this is maybe his most personal movie because at the time he's making it, he has no experience other than his own life to write about. So it all feels so real. And like a lot of the reviews I read for the movie kind of said that they felt it almost had like a documentary feel to it, not because it feels so real, but just because the relationships between the people feel so like normal. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, exactly. I know it sounds funny to say it like that, or it's like, duh, but they feel so lived in and so real. Like these really are just two. Especially because you have unknown actors at the time, too. And it's a small director. So it almost feels like, where did this come from, you know? And it's like, I don't know, four friends planning to make a movie. And then the movie being about a heist. It's like those two situations are not that different, you know? It's like they are pulling off a heist by making this movie and getting away with it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it all just feels so connected to who he is as a person. So bear with me here. I kind of wrote a lot. This is the story of Wes Anderson. So Wes Anderson was born on May 1st, 1969, Houston, Texas. He's the son of a realtor and an archaeologist who divorced when he was 8 years old. He's the middle child of a set of three boys. His older brother is a physician, and his younger brother is a painter and writer whose art has appeared in several of his films. His family's literally the Royal Tenenbaums, you know, like the Texas version of them. As a young child, he made silent movies on his dad's Super 8 of his family and friends, like I said. In college, he worked part-time as a projectionist on the theater camp at the University of Texas. Hook 'em horns.
Yeah.
And this is where he meets Owen Wilson, who becomes his future roommate. And the interesting thing I thought about this, they just like us for real. These two, when they first met each other, did not like each other. They shared a screenplay class. Or a playwright class, they sat on opposite sides of the theater from each other the entire semester, and then it finally took until their sophomore year for them to bond over, wow, how about that, movies, right? These two writers. And when they're first kicking around this idea for the movie Bottle Rocket, they imagined it was going to be some dark, gritty, Goodfellas-esque drama about, you know, pulling off heists or whatever, right? But then in an interview, Owen Wilson says, he's like, we just realized we didn't have the background to do something like that. And, you know, that's kind of where this Wes Anderson, like, irreverence, weird, quirky attitude comes from. It's just like, yeah, I want to make The Godfather, but I don't know. I'm just some guy from Texas. So, like,
that's not what's in front of me. Yeah.
I've always thought a movie that was comparable to Wes Anderson's style of, like, the kind of life he captures is, like, Napoleon Dynamite. Not the humor,
but
it's like the world that it's in, where you're like, is this real? And it's like, this is extremely real. This might be the realest thing. you know, like, yes, in the Midwest or in Idaho or wherever. Like, people are like this, you know?
I agree. No, yeah. He thought he was making good time, huh?
That's what he wanted to do. Yeah. <That's it. laughs> and then I just started doing, like, you know, I started doing more research, kind of digging into things. And I found out that they wrote a lot of this at this cafe called the Cosmic Cup in Dallas, right? It was located in a neighborhood that Luke and Owen Wilson lived in, and they just spent a lot of time there, you know, as people did in the 90s via friends, via this movie, you know, Frasier, a lot of time spent in coffee shops in the 90s.
You just talk, man.
Hang out, write movies, right? And this is what really got me, and I was like, oh, this is a juicy little morsel right here. The guy who plays Kumar in this movie, and he plays like various different like butler henchman-esque roles throughout the movies. Like in Royal Tenenbaums, he's Royal's like sidekick.
Okay.
Right? This man, his son owned the cafe, and he's his dad, so he would hang out there a lot or whatever. And it's this like hippie Indian vegan cafe where like you can do yoga lessons there and buy like the, you know, buy the Kama Sutra, you know, whatever. Like,
exactly.
This is where these guys are hanging out right in this movie. And they're like, why don't we just put this guy in the movie? Because he used to be in vaudeville and he performed on the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse a long time ago, right? So they were like, this guy became an actor because Wes Anderson just met him in a coffee shop.
And he kind of was like, he had some type of history, I guess. So
yeah,
that's it with that. Explains why, you know, the movies can get as big as they can. The budgets have gotten bigger. The stories have gotten grander. But the core of all of this, and obviously reflecting especially off of the last episode that we did, was his last movie, Asteroid City, that the core of the movie is still that integralness of that family, that she would exist, the relationships that would exist in a situation like in Asteroid City. You know, there's an alien. And so in the same type of, like, what we said, laying down the foundation here, the same type of conversations that the brothers have here is translated into making sure that these top actors talk to each other like that.
Yeah. And also I think too, what carries on throughout his filmography is there's an interview of him when he's really young and he's saying too, he was like, the important thing to me is that we did it our way. And that is definitely something that carries out throughout the entirety of his filmography. Right. And then I saw a short on YouTube, like one of those fucking fake TikToks or whatever they have. And this is pre, I don't know, the last 5 years, I think. This is older than that. And they were asking him about his style and what does he think about the naysayers and the people who do like his work, too. Like, where does he fall in line with this? Like, does it bother you when people say, like, that's a Wes Anderson type movie or that's a Wes Anderson style? And he was like, I could give into it and do something that is so different and prove to people that I'm capable of doing these other things. But at the end of the day, I only want to make movies the way I see them in my head and the way I want them to look and how I want them to feel and how I want them to sound. And if I have to live with people judging me because, oh, it's derivative, each movie's derivative of the last one and they're all kind of the same, he's like, well, then so be it. I'm okay with that. I can live with that as long as it's what I want it to be.
Yeah, I think similar, just because you said how you saw that, I had seen his, I don't know when it was, but it was, I'm pretty sure, years after the Bottle Rocket came out, and like the reaction to Bottle Rocket and how people would get up and leave, and he was sitting there and he got really nervous about it, and he just kind of knew, like, oh, people aren't liking this. And then he's like, I got up and left and went to projection room because I just couldn't really, he's like, I made sure nobody saw me because I didn't want to add to it. But so, you know, it's
Owen Wilson almost joined the Marines because of this movie. Like, he was like, fuck,
it's
like,
not gonna work.
I don't think this is gonna work. I listened to a piece of the Criterion commentary that they did for this movie, you know, many years after,
right?
And Wes Anderson, yeah, he kind of, just harping on what you were saying, is that the screenings and the reshoots and everything else like that, where he just kind of almost walked away from the whole thing after, you know, his one go, kind of like, fuck this, like this sucks. This, I hate this. Like, I love making the movies, but all of this part of it, I hate it and I don't want to deal with it. And Owen Wilson even said too, like, it got to the point where, like, we would have to go get him. Like, he would lock himself in his room or hotel or wherever they're staying. And, like, you have to come out. You have to keep going. Like, we have to finish this movie, you know, because there was a point where they all kind of had thought about, like, I don't know if I want to do this, you know?
Yeah, they were invested, though, too, you know, so they had to go for it. But I think that's what reminded me of that is you bringing up that how important it is to him to do it the way they wanted to do it, the way I wanted to do it, is the way he says it. And I think it's because of that, you know, like, he even himself maybe doubted himself the way that he had done it. And Rushmore doesn't get made without this, without the right people liking it, without someone like James Caan, like you said, everybody who kind of vouched for him. So, you know, even in an inspirational way, sometimes you're too hard on yourself. And that's how you kind of find out people who end up being special. They'll always feel that way about themselves. And this movie, although, like you said, I'm in agreement with you, isn't one of my favorite movies, I do think it's ambitious. And that's what ends up being his thing as well. Not just the style, but his movies are ambitious in the way that, I think the biggest thing that I picked up on here, and I think ends up being a problem here because of the budget, is that he always ends up still wanting to tell you about everybody's life before and after and really detailing it, right? And everybody here gets their happy ending in some way. And I think that when you have a cast small like that, a movie that has a runtime that isn't as, you know, as much time as he gets now, it does feel like you're trying to tackle too many things at once.
Yeah, I think for me, where it falls apart as a movie and where he learned to change how he tells a story and how he includes all of these characters is, you know, in the very beginning of the film, there's like a narration. It's something that was there from day one and is carried on throughout, which is like narration with pictures of, well, photographs, still images of photographs, diaries, journal entries, right?
Yeah, 75-year plan,
right?
The exact, that's the stuff that I'm talking
about. In a later film, he would do one of those for every character. Boom, 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 boom. And then you would know everything within a, like 20, 30 seconds, right?
Right.
Or like, you know, you think about the French Dispatch, when he's introducing all of the writers, right? This guy hasn't written a sentence. This guy writes too much. This guy stands in the hallway. And he learned to, like, overboard you with information almost, right? And I think in this movie, it lingers, and I felt like the disconnection here from the rest of his movies is that Wes Anderson's movies are very, I don't want to say plot-driven, but, like, as in, this is going to happen, so then we're going to show this, and then this, and then this, and then this, and then boom. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's about the journey. It isn't really about the plot unfolding. You know, the plot presents itself, and then you're along for the ride. It isn't Wes Anderson movies are never a mystery of what's going to happen, you know? And I think the best example of that, honestly, because I watched it pretty recently, is Fantastic Mr. Fox, of like how his movies work. And I think in this one, it's just, I don't know. It does feel like not even a budget thing, but just like a director who doesn't know how to rein in his story to like tell it in a way that isn't wasting any time. Because for this being not the longest movie, it does also feel kind fluff. Of like a lot of fluff, a lot of pacing issues. You know, like this movie, even as a feature, could probably be 60 minutes, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I just wanted to say that because, you know, we're watching in the background. You can easily watch the movie, but I understand the whole premise of bringing in Ines, right? And like the innocence of the way they fall in love, I guess, if you were to call it that. But that's what you said, like before. And I know that its purpose is to serve that, or to show that somebody who up until this point you think about like, what a hooligan, right? Is just vulnerable to a state that I'm like, oh man, he's just really sad and he still wants the same things that everybody else wants, and ends up being like a driven plot about him being in love. But I do end up thinking that it really does stop from the boys. Mm-hmm. Like, and I'm kind of like, the premise of the movie, like you said, is the heist and pulling off these heists and, you know, James Caan's character and doing that. And it ends up feeling like the Ines stuff is just like a sidetrack story. That's like a half of another story. That's just him. And I end up feeling like, okay, so here he, like, Luke Wilson's character gets the check mark because he falls in love and he's happy. You know, Owen Wilson's character gets the check mark because he goes back in the crew and he's happy with his brother. And, like, everybody feels like they get their check mark, which I end up in this movie, like you said, for 90 minutes, end up feeling like, I don't think you needed to do that in that way that you did it. And it's almost very, it's a good thing because you end up feeling like, I haven't seen Rushmore yet, but it's going to, I can obviously tell based off what I've seen that he ends up, like you said, learning to be like, let me cut this.
I'm not really sure how I feel about her because I feel like, as you said it, my opinion kind of shifted a bit because I do feel like the movie has a lot of pacing issues and stuff like that. But I honestly do think that it adds, her side plot adds something to the film because, like, as for like the themes of this film, I do kind of see this almost as a coming of age film, even though these are men who are in probably college age. I wouldn't say they're like 18, 19. If I had to guess, they're in their early 20s, right?
Still coming of age. Yeah.
So yeah, so kind not so much coming of age, but like just becoming a man. Men, right? Yeah. And I did see that, you know, our three main characters of Dignan, Bob, and Anthony, right? It's just kind of growing up. They all end up, like, none of them want to be criminals, really. Mm-hmm. They just don't know what else to do with their life, right?
Very similar to City of God.
Yeah, like, this is just kind of like a lost group of guys who are, I don't know, like they let Dignan be their kind of leader, right? But who is he to be leading anyone, right?
Yeah.
So I almost see the Inez, like, you know, Anthony and Inez falling in love as like a, this is something that actually happens in real life. Like, yeah, you and your boys have a plan. Like, oh, we're going to start a band and whatever, whatever. And then like, actually, I don't know. I fell in love with this girl and this is better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I do see that, but I also think it just lingers a little too long. Like, I do think there is a way of doing it where it doesn't have to take up, like, I don't know, 25 minutes of the movie. But also it might just be the director himself, you know, it's like, is this a heist movie? Is this a coming of age movie? It's like, it's a lot of stuff. And I just don't think that he is ready at this point to get that done in such a way where it's like, it makes sense. You know,
if we had the sound bites right now, I think this whole episode would be Henri basically saying, Vic, I see what he's doing. I see it.
Yeah.
He's cooking.
And like, I wanted to talk about the, like, I wrote for this movie, the, like the blueprint, right. Of like what's there and what's not there. We can get to the synopsis too in a little bit. I mean, I don't really want to talk about the movie too much. Honestly, I kind of like, because I don't really love this movie, I think it's more fun to talk about this movie as like a seeing it for what it is, not what I wish it was, you know?
Right.
So, but as for the blueprint, like I do think the film ranges between the good to pretty good. Like I would say three and a half. I don't think it's a two. I don't think it's a four. I do think that, I don't know. Like there's just something about it where it's like, you see it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you see it, like, okay, this guy could do something. But as for the things that are established here that become like the trademark, like Andersonisms that everyone's trying to recreate, it's like the meticulous planning, right? Like that never goes away. And like, that just must be something about Wes Anderson. And I said in the Asteroid City episode, it's like something about being a filmmaker. It's like filmmakers, writers, it's like you have to be this meticulous because what you're trying to bring a world to life. And you can't do that unless you are
bringing it to
on me. Your shit. You know what I mean? Of like crossing your T's and dotting your I's, right? So the meticulous planning, the close-ups of journals, diaries, photos, while narration is said, quick close-ups of actions and motions, like shooting a gun, right? Like you see the gun load, you see it go off, you see the reaction. The overall whimsical nature of it, right? I also noticed in a lot of Wes Anderson movies, I think what makes them so silly and quote like, you know, quirky, that word that people like to use, is that there's a lot of coincidence in the movies. Like he uses coincidence a lot to push the plot, like because it's like they take place in these like elevated fake, I don't know, like bespoke worlds, right? Where it's like I don't know if this is actually in a Wes Anderson movie, but like something I could imagine is like two guys talking and then the camera pulls out and cuts to the left and it's like, oh, the door's right there. You know what I mean?
I like, see what you mean. Yeah.
Like just small little things like that. Really long takes, right? Especially when like you think of like the neighborhood scene in the beginning where they're going to rob Anthony's house as a practice test. And there's this long conversation about cardiovascular and physical exercise and things like that, right? And what I learned in the commentary actually is that that was going to be a talk about, I think they said The Godfather or movies or something like that. And the studio was just like,
this is too much.
Enough. We saw Reservoir Dogs. We don't need another new guy doing this.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
So they were like, make it something else. And then it just became a long talk about athletics. But I do think that that became a staple piece of Wes Anderson's work of like these extremely long takes of these long kind of tedious conversations.
Similar to Quentin, right? Like you brought up Reservoir Dogs, like where the conversation, obviously they approach it differently, but where the script, I think that's why they end up standing out, like I said here, because the characters do feel fleshed out and the conversations they have feel real.
Yeah, and you know, right now we're seeing one of the moments with Inez too, and it brings me to my next point, is like that one of the things that people have always missed about the Wes Anderson movies is between the style and the flair and the panache that he puts on the screen, it's like those small intimate conversations are really the meat and potatoes of the movies, and those usually get overlooked, honestly. I don't want to say by film people, but just your average audience, you know, oh, that's the guy who does the thing, right? Like, but you never bring up that he has these really intense, meaningful conversations between moments of flair, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think in Astro City, the one that stands out to me the most is Window. He's trying to figure out, you know, just a sidetrack, kind of like in a movie that's so meta to itself about actors playing actors in a play, and then the actor in the the actor in the play now questioning what this is all about. And that moment again, when I think this proves two points to me, what you were saying is that, like, Wes Anderson understands that the story here is so straightforward that you can mix up and throw in 4, 5, 6, 7 layers of stuff in the middle, but the direct line is still there. Mm-hmm. So, like, kind of like you said, when you watch the movie, you're like, as meta to the actors, you kind of know where the movie is heading. You're not going to be surprised of where the movie is heading. And then those moments that you're talking about between the flare, it's like when he does start to question the whole, you know, point of the movie, which I feel like where the messages come out is the conversation with Margot Robbie, which is in the own movie, they joke about it being coincidence as a small role character, but the essence of that conversation that you're talking about that is very personal ends up being like the conclusion that our main character gets to. So it's found in, you know, a 5-minute intimate small talk between two actors.
And those are the things that really just end up getting lost to most people.
You know? And that's his style.
Oh, the symmetry.
Yeah. And that's his style.
And then, you know, the thing that's really his style. Yeah, exactly. And then the last thing I saw or heard, actually, that I was like, oh, this is where it starts and it carries through, is like the 60s, 70s, 80s punk rock and roll soundtrack. So, like, man, does this guy know how to pick music?
You yeah, know? It's that's
like
true.
Rolling Stones, Beatles, David Bowie, just like, it's always like, oh, sick, right? And usually set to slow motion too, like that's another thing, the slow motion soundtrack going
in this one, like, is pretty funny
happening too, most for the most part
in this movie. The slow-mo so pretty, it's pretty bad.
And then, you know, to the other side of the coin, for the lack of style, for, you know, I don't know if I really mean it like that, but that's the easiest way to say it, is like the no symmetry, right? It's like nowhere to be seen in this movie, not even one or two shots. I don't even think they imagined that. If I had to guess, everything in this movie was probably shot either on a tripod or like maybe handheld. I don't even know if there's any handheld shots in this movie. You know, honestly, I don't even know who the cinematographer is for this movie. I'm going to have to look that up. No deliberate color palettes, right?
Nope. So
that is something that becomes, like, once he has a you know, some change in his pocket and he can start swinging his you-know-what around.
You know what it is?
Pink, green, purple, you know?
You know what it is? Man went to Europe once, huh?
Hey, man. Dudes went to Europe, came back, big bro, I'm different.
Yeah, be like, the palettes, dude. The
you want a croissant? It's a croissant.
Exactly. My man be like, you were talking about his origin, talking about Houston. And you're like, this man might as well be European now.
Yeah. You know, at some point, I do want to get to, maybe not in this episode, but like, where does he become the character Wes Anderson? Yeah. The persona, you know? Where does he become Tilda Swinton playing Wes Anderson as Wes Anderson? You know? Like, that's who I'm interested in, is where does he become this like Ziggy Stardust like character of like, I'm in on this. Because he is, you like that. That's a huge thing about him too. Is like, I do truly believe that he, as much as he loves this and he is authentically himself, and there's not really a lot of people like him. I feel like everyone who is like him is considered a variant. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A la Tyler the Creator. You know, like even him, he's one of my favorite artists, and who's one of his favorite artists? Wes Anderson. You know. Dudes go to France once, right? They come back all of a sudden plaid checkered suits and things like that, right?
Rally cars and shit.
Yeah, little BM dubs, huh?
What the hell? I'll be like, Germany. Like, do you know what those kind of cars are?
No symmetry, no color palette. And then I would say that these actually feel like people instead of characters or even caricatures. Like, I think that a lot of his other characters do end up feeling like, you know, like comparing it to Asteroid City, because it's the last movie. It's a multi-layered, complex character, but Jason Schwartzman playing this actor who's playing this film photographer but the film photographer is really a play on, and I heard this in a podcast and saw it the second time I watched the movie, was that he's like half Ernest Hemingway, half Francis Ford Coppola, you know?
Yeah.
It's like he looks like Francis Ford Coppola in Apocalypse Now, but his character is Ernest Hemingway, and then or no, sorry, John Steinbeck, right?
Okay.
And then even his name, it's Steinbeck. You know what I mean? It's like, and, so there's levels there. He's Norm Hall
from California too.
Guy. Yeah, you know, so it's like he really is. He's operating on a whole other frequency by the time we get to something like Asteroid City, as opposed to this. Like Dignan, I don't know. I feel like we all probably know a guy like this. Am I a guy like this?
His characters get so, his characters get so niche that the podcast is named after a niche thing he created, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we've acknowledged it before, but what better time than now? So it's like this podcast is even a riff on Wes Anderson in The Grand Budapest. So, yeah. I don't think it could ever be understated or overstated how much he means to this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, again, as somebody who, I would say since Fantastic Mr. Fox kind of was one of the directors that I watched out for, but Wes Anderson, and I don't feel like that's like a special. I feel like that's when everybody kind of started paying attention, is that that's why I had to pay homage, you know, and retroactively go and be like, even though I know Bottle Rocket, just based off of watching the trailer, be like, no, this isn't like anything like what he's now. But, you know, you have to pay respect to where it starts. And then as you do see it retroactively, you do kind of see how it's inspiring, I guess, for anybody who would want to make a film or anything creative, that you could be laying down foundations to things that somebody else will see. Or especially with movies, because there's such, you know, they're just money drainers. I'm sure they lost so much money on this, even though they didn't make any money used.
Big like time. It was $5 to $7 million, and it made $500,000.
Exactly. And, you know, that's like, those are L's you're going to have to take.
Yeah.
Especially in filmmaking.
Oh, okay. So, he's been there since the beginning. It's Robert Yeoman is the cinematographer. Sorry, I had to bring this up because I remember reading it the other day and thinking, I was like, really? He's been with him since
He's also the OG too?
Like, yeah, he's been there.
Part of the crew? The
beginning. Yeah. I mean, he's also known for doing other movies, too. Like, I mean, he's done a Kevin Smith movie. He's done, you know, Gus Van Sant's movie, Drugstore Cowboy.
I'm sure
you've heard of that movie. Have you seen
it? Just him? Gus Van Sant. Just because of Gus, when I was reviewing this. I haven't. That sounds cool.
Yeah, anyway, so there's, like, Wes Anderson is his guy. He's been there the entire time. He also shot Bridesmaids. That's funny. I'm just looking at some of the other movies he's done. He's even going to do Henry Sugar, too, which is, like, that's going to be nice that we're going to be able to do that episode as well when it comes out.
Which one?
What's it called? The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. It's that short film that's coming out for Netflix with
Jeff Patel.
It's got some of the Grand Budapest guys in it. It's got, who else? Oh, Ben Kingsley is in it, right?
Yeah.
And it's based off of a Roald Dahl. So the guy who did Willy Wonka.
It's coming out within the next 2 months, right?
Something I believe so.
Yeah.
Hopefully we can pan this thing out and make it last long enough to to do that. But, you know, who knows?
I think it is pretty soon. It's either next month for sure.
This is already a convoluted mess because it's like we've done two of his movies. Now we're going back. Another one's coming out.
That's true. We have done two.
I forgot. What it is, man. I mean, I do think that maybe when Henry Sugar comes out, maybe what we do is we do Bottle Rocket through
Darjeeling.
I think Isle of Dogs would be the last one. And then when Henry Sugar comes back, or Henry Sugar comes out, we do the retrospective of like the revisit. How do you feel about The French Dispatch? And how do you feel about Asteroid City since the time they've come out? You know, because I already know I feel differently about The French Dispatch than I did when we first reviewed it.
Yeah.
So I've watched that movie probably 3 or 4 times now.
Yeah. I mean, The French Dispatch I've watched twice since we saw it in theater and did the episode for it. So just based off of I like the first story on there. Well, I actually like the Timothy Chalamet one a lot too. So I just like playing those small little excerpts for a while. But I mean, it is interesting because, you know, that Netflix short that's going to come on is basically what he would have done in The French Dispatch, one of the stories, you know?
Yeah. So I wanted to go back. Hold on here. Let's see. Let's just do the synopsis. We can talk about the characters, really. Upon his release from a mental hospital, following a nervous breakdown, the directionless Anthony joins his friend Dignan, who seems far less sane than the former. Dignan has hatched a harebrained scheme for an as-yet-specified crime spree that somehow involves his former boss, the supposedly legendary Mr. Henry. like I said, I don't want to go into the plot too much. Not going to spoil anything for people because I feel like this is probably a movie a lot of people haven't seen. I bet you if you asked most people, they wouldn't even know that this is his first movie. I feel like, at least for me, when I was young, I remember The Royal Tenenbaums being the first one that my mom put on, and it wasn't like I sat there, I didn't sit my ass down and listen. Yeah. I just remember watching, coming in and out of the room, be like, hey, those guys have track suits. Like, I was like, look, they're all wearing the same thing, right? Like the Ben Stiller family.
It's Ben Stiller.
Yeah, hey, it's him. I knew who he was.
From Meet the Fockers.
But
not yet.
So we won't get too much into the plot and everything, but it's not even really, like, the plot of the movie is not what the movie's really about either. That's why. I don't think it's that important. It's like the heist. It's like there's a few of them. I do think that the first one is actually pretty funny. The one they, when they robbed the bookstore.
Yeah.
And you know what's funny, too, is like that the guy who is the bookstore clerk is also, like, I think he is the guy who owned the cafe.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. I was gonna, cause that makes sense. Because when you said that, I was looking at that scene was playing, and I was like, this guy kind of looks similar. It reminded me like he kind of looks similar too.
And I do think that that's a good scene because it has a lot of the Wes Anderson isms right there. It's like the kind of like high stakes tension, I guess, that he like as high tension as it could get in his silly movies, right? But then like even the way like he robs the place, he's like. Yeah, I like left my sweater in there. Can I come in?
Yeah.
And then Owen Wilson's like, oh, you let him in? Well, I forgot my sweater too. Where? And he's like, oh, I left some money in here. And where? He's like, the cash register. Or like even when they're robbing the guys, he's like, you only have these small bags. Like they're small, like popcorn sized bags. He's like, just put all the money in those.
In the bunch of them.
He's like, don't call me an idiot. You're right. The old guy. He's like, sorry, sir.
I think another part. Because right after that, there is the heist where you think they're just stealing from a house, right?
In the beginning,
yeah.
It's I guess Anthony's that's house.
Yeah, and then it's Anthony's
house.
And then I just like that he tells him, he's like, maybe we should steal your house next time. It's like, and then he just got, again, you find out these lived characters are like, oh, I don't like my parents aren't God, rich.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why he's the hooligan, man. That's why he's never home. But I do think those little excerpts right there between them also do work because, one, they're brothers, so they're comfortable enough to really, the relationship that they had would be something that is now very integral to a Wes Anderson film.
Yeah, so one of the funniest lines in the movie, too, is like at the end where he's like, isn't it funny that you were in the nut house and now I'm the one in jail?
Yeah.
Right? Because like, that's a through line throughout the movie is that like Dignan is the actual delusional nutcase, you know, who thinks that they're going to become these legendary heist men and that I've got my life planned out for the next 75 years. And I know that there's a lot of Owen Wilson in the character because he is one of the co-writers, but I just feel like him and Wes Anderson, when they did become friends, they must have realized that they're kind of two sides of the same coin, you know? And also the fact that Owen Wilson was thinking about joining the Marines, like, it doesn't kind of catch me by surprise that a guy would be this detailed and planned about his future, but also end up in the Marines because it's like, you go, like, a lot of people, no offense to any veterans or whatever, but it's like, you know, there's people who go there because they're just lost and like they think that they're Dignans, you know, like they think they got it figured out and then they're like, I don't know, just let the United States military figure it out for me.
Exactly.
You know, because then it's like they end up just like turning to crime, you know, and like I don't fucking know, you know.
And it's always kind of really just shows how like small opportunity is and how much of a difference it can be. And you know, Owen Wilson, now we've had a whole career of Owen Wilson. He doesn't even come out in movies as much anymore. You know, my man's doing Loki, the last thing I saw him from. You know what I mean? Like, this is somebody who, like, talking about was one movie or one critic or one day away from being like, I'm just going to be a Marine.
I do think it's cool, too, that he was a writer, right?
Like, yeah.
I find that to be honestly really interesting because it's like how much of the Andersonisms are also
his
Owen Wilson. Yeah.
And I mean, there's, like I said, very prevalent in our life. This reminds me of the little side excerpt of the video of him skating, right?
Oh yeah.
Owen Wilson skating.
the skit and Yeah Right, I believe.
Yeah, but he's just like a very cool guy. And you find out that it's just a lot of the times when they're directing the movies, Wes Anderson does get a lot of the full credit. Obviously, he gets his writing credits, but I think Wes Anderson also identifies that. A lot of these movies do end up being just kind of similar to our podcast, end up being like a culmination of collaboration, right?
Yeah, so he was... Sorry, I was looking this up since you... we were talking about the writing. He did do... Rushmore, and he did the Royal Tenenbaums, and then it appears to be the last time he did any kind of writing. And I think that's interesting too, because honestly, my first contact with Owen Wilson, the actor, is Meet the Parents. So when I was introduced to Owen Wilson, I never even like thought about him being like a serious actor. You know, from there on, I kind of seen him as this like comedic, family friendly guy that you know. Meet the Parents, Zoolander, Marley and Me, you know what I mean? Like, just movies that are very safe.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, oh, wow. Yeah, one of the most famous Wes Anderson things is Owen Wilson. Oh, wow. Right? I kind of wish we maybe had a little more of this fucking Owen Wilson, you know? A young Robert Mitchum.
You know, it's funny that you bring that, because even though I didn't have the same introduction to him, what I did think of him as compared to what I know now of him is the first movie I ever saw him in was Shanghai Nights.
Noon or Nights? Do you remember? Because
there's Yeah. It's...
And Me Too. That's Nights. Another one.
It's Nights, I think, 'cause it's the first one. But, like, yeah, like, which, same thing, like, sidebar, obviously. But, like, Jackie Chan is a character, or is a actor that, like, as a kid, I just thought he was always in funny movies. And then you find out, oh, shit, like, he's very integral to international cinema. Yeah. And then similar here to Owen Wilson, you know, where he's like, no, but he's actually part of a very important career and independent movie. Like, obviously, this movie, like you said, we may not feel that strong about it, but a lot of people do. A lot of people really think this is not his worst movie. They think this is one of his better movies. So although I disagree, I do think this movie has a cult love for it.
I think, okay, we feel this way about quite a few filmmakers, right? But you only have so much time on a podcast. I don't really want to spend time talking about filmmakers that I don't think are special, right?
Yeah.
But I do think that he is one of the rare breeds of almost every movie is better than the last one. You know, like, I do think I have my favorites, so I don't know if I'm undercutting my own argument right there, because it's like some of my favorites... My early favorite is Royal Tenenbaums, and then it's like, I don't think everything between Royal Tenenbaums and, say, Grand Budapest is worse. I'm like, no, that's my favorite, you know? So I think he falls in that category, though, of like, he just kept getting better and better and better, and I do think that even now, up into Asteroid City, that's like, he's really, like, peaking. He'd be like, I don't know if he can get better than this. I guess we'll see with something like Henry Sugar, right? But... he doesn't really have too many ups and downs for me. So I don't really think it's a shame to say that, like, his first movie is his worst, because we're still talking about a 3-star movie here out of 5, which is like, yeah dude, I mean, sure. There's probably a lot of filmmakers who it's like, dude, what was that? Like David Fincher with Alien 3, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
You're like, dude, you made that? You know, like, fucking Stanley Kubrick is like, I don't want anyone to know I made Spartacus.
Yeah, like, do not associate that with
yeah,
me.
Yeah, or David Lynch. Oh, don't tell anybody I made Dune. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there really is these filmmakers out there who, like, are very special filmmakers. Steven Spielberg's comedy movie, 1942, you know? That man can tell any story except a funny one. You know, he can touch horror, he can touch sci-fi, fantasy, Marty too, whatever. Huh? Anything, family, drama, historical epic drama, ask him to do funny ha-ha.
Musicals.
Yeah, haha, silly shit. He's like, I don't know what to do.
David Lynch, too, don't ask him about Dune, but he made the Disney movie. He's like, that one's fine.
Yeah, he made that movie, The Straight Line, right?
Yeah.
Which is like, that's even funnier, because you know what? He's ripe for this kind of project, because he also doesn't have like an immense amount of movies. You know, it is hard. Like, I don't want to tie myself to a project where it's like, this guy's got 25 movies. You know?
Exactly.
It's like, Papa Scorsese, I don't know if we'll ever do that, because it's like, there's too many. Maybe we'll do, like, eras, you know what I mean?
He's still alive. You'll get the ones where he's still alive, right? Like, yeah. As he takes them out, we'll be here.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? As much as we talk about him, we haven't even done one of his movies yet. We haven't done an old one, and there hasn't been one in the time that the podcast has been out.
Actually, yeah, that is pretty crazy. I mean,
we've never done Kubrick.
It's going to happen this year. It's going to happen this year.
I mean, I feel like there's some filmmakers we respect so much. I'm like, I would never disrespect them with my caveman thoughts about my
Kubrick, huh? Be like, let's talk about his. Let's talk about the allegations. Yeah. Talk about the moon landing. The fake moon landing.
You ever notice how people stare directly into the camera?
The Kubrick stare, huh? Yeah. No, I mean, I agree with you. Back on track, just like Wes Anderson, it does feel like we've been here. Even this movie, we were alive for. Obviously, we didn't fucking watch movies, but
2 years old, bro. You didn't see it when it came out?
Yeah. Huh. You don't remember this on the movie theater?
I witnessed it. I was around it while it was on.
Exactly.
Actually, I don't think my parents have seen this movie. Or if they did, there's no shot they remember.
They're like, Bottle Rocket. Nah.
My mom would probably lie and say yeah. I love
it. I remember, yeah.
I've never heard you mention it in my 29 years of life.
Have you seen Bottle Package? Oh, I love Bottle Package.
Bottle 2 liter? Oh, man. But, you know, as for the movie, like we said, there's a lot of funny shit here. There's a lot of heartfelt shit here. I do think that it is kind of a mess. Coming of age story. But overall, where do you fall on this film? Like, is it a 3? Is it a 3.5? Would you recommend this movie to people?
I give this a 3. And I was like, watched it. I gave it a 3 because I did feel like there are certain points where I was like, okay, I get where this is going. But then, like you said, it lingers from other moments where I thought it was really funny or that laying the foundation. Even though I don't feel like the pacing for the Inez stuff is well done, I still like her character. So I do give it a 3. Would I recommend it to, you know, to people who watch as many movies as me and you do? Yeah. I think, to be able to put the star up that, oh, you're a cinephile. Have you watched every Wes Anderson movie? Yeah, I don't know. There's certain ones. Maybe it's just in our opinion, cause you brought him up, David Lynch too, where I just feel like they're so up of the inspiration of stuff that I'd like to do, or I just look up to them so much, where even something like you said, a 3-star Wes Anderson movie is still better than any shit that I think I could make. So I'm still very endeared to it, you know, where I'm like, even this simple thing that I may have issues with is very hard to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel you. Because, like, I was thinking, last night, I decided to watch Ocean's 11 for the first time since 2001.
Sick.
And a lot of people really like that movie, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's fucking great, right? And it did reinvigorate the heist genre. There's so many movies after Ocean's 11 that came out that are just trying to riff on that. And honestly, I think it's just okay. You know, like, and like, I do feel kind of like, it was like similar. It's like, you know, like, not every 3-star movie's built the same. Where it's like, I gave Bottle Rocket 3 stars because I was like, A for effort, you know what I mean? But with Ocean's 11, I gave it a 3 because I was like, as much as people say this is like, I've seen people say this is a perfect movie, right? It's like, this is a not like as in terms of like, you know, it's one of our great movies of all time, but it's like, it's just perfectly executed, right? And it's like, I feel no tension when I watch that movie. For a movie about a heist, you would think for at least a second, you'd be like, they were going to get caught. In Ocean's 11, I didn't feel that way once. Like, the whole entire time I was like, maybe it's just because I had seen it before, but I was like, okay, like, you know, it's like it can happen where too many things go right, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or you're like, I don't know, did you ever think that this bad thing would happen? And then that's why I like rated it a little lower, because I'm like, this is the most fluff nothing dad movie I've ever seen, you know, of like, haha, sick, you know.
I get what you're saying.
I don't know if I'm really elaborating this point well, but look, I guess another way of elaborating this would be like when I watch How to Blow Up a Pipeline, right? Wait, that'd be funny if we muted that part. Like,
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Same thing. It's such a good movie, but I know that pipeline's going to fucking blow up. Like, so then I'm also just kind of like, how long is this movie? Like, okay, oh shit, it's going to blow up in 20 minutes. You know? And it takes it down a notch for me, because it's like, how can there really, for a movie that's being a pressure cooker, how can it be that when I know what's going to happen? You know? And it's like the same thing with Ocean's 11. I know they're going to get away. And especially because I know that there's 12 and 13.
Talking about this reminds me, because he's on screen, Mr. Henry, which is played by James Caan. I did think that I really enjoyed that, because they're love of movies. They said, and he used to be a really good thief. Talking about movies that are high tension, some of my favorite Thief that he's in is, I just thought it was funny that Bottle Rocket kind of put him as a character who was a really good thief before.
I mean, it's even kind of meta, like you said earlier, like about his movies. It was like they wanted to make The Godfather. Who'd they get in their movie? James Caan. You know, and it's like, oh, he's playing a legendary, supposed, you know, heistman, a heister, a criminal thief, right? Whatever.
My favorite thing about that, I'm sorry to cut you off, is that they talk about like somebody still has to do the front job. Oh, yeah. That's my favorite. That's like my favorite thing. Like, it's not easy.
He has landscaping, and they're like, everybody has to have a front. And you actually have to do it.
Somebody has to do the landscaping, you know. But I did think that again, because I didn't know how much of a, obviously, you know, most directors are student of the game, but I didn't know that they were so inspired by Goodfellas and Martin Scorsese, and then that, like, you know, and then The Godfather, and then like you said, this makes so much sense that you would get James Caan. And then that in the movie, there's like a, he was a really good legendary like thief or whatever.
Like Thief.
Yeah, and we were just kind of talking about movies that have high tension. Like, so that you don't know how they're going to end. I mean, the movie's called Thief, yes, but that's a movie that I think is so well executed in those aspects, where the movie doesn't, very similar to the Safdie brothers. Like, you don't know where it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Wes Anderson and the Safdies couldn't be on any more opposite sides. Yeah. But I don't know, maybe that's just a personal bias of what I enjoy in a film, is like, I don't want to just know everything. And then, like, I think a better example of that is like Fantastic Mr. Fox. It's like, there's so many heists that take place in that movie, but there's, you know, for a second, you're like, I don't know, is he going to get away? Fuck, they blew off his tail. Like, you know? And I don't know, with this movie, it almost felt like, because it's so small stakes, because it's such a small movie, such a small budget, first time filmmakers, it's like, it just kind of ends, and then you're like, yeah, like, I don't know. I guess they all got a happy ending. You know what I mean? It's like, that's cute, you know, not to be like demeaning, but like, that's cute. Yeah. Cute movie.
I guess you're like, at the end of the day, it has become like the age that they're at, like, you had schemes, you had plans.
Yeah.
You know? And like, again, that's the realization at that age, to be like, oh, you could talk all this shit, but
I suggest you do what your parents did, sir. Yeah. Get a job.
Exactly. You know, and it's still admirable. I think, I still enjoyed watching it. I think, again, I haven't seen too many movies where Owen Wilson is kind of being given a more serious role. And I think I did just really enjoy that aspect. And I do think, the characters here are very, it does remind me of almost same way like Sean Baker movies as well, where the characters, like I said, they're very real, but not as obviously,
not gritty, underworld, underbelly,
but still very, very like, shit. I mean, this is very Texan, right? Is what this movie is too, ultimately. Yeah. Very Dallas.
So, I mean, I feel like that kind of wraps it up nicely, right? I mean, do you have much more to say? Is there anything you want to get out before this episode ends?
No, I mean,
we're obviously
going to keep talking
centric for the next couple of weeks at least. So,
yeah, exactly. So I think anything else that, pertaining to him might come out in the other episodes. I mean, like I said, I'm just excited that we are doing this, and that like I can say that I've seen the movie. There is, like, right now we're watching it, and so the funny aspect of him with the yellow suit and then getting made fun of, and then that made Luke Wilson's character be like, all right, I'm gonna join, and seeing how, like, you know. And then you have right after James Caan's character practicing, I guess, kung fu or karate,
taekwondo, something of that nature, right?
Yeah. Again, this is like the comedic aspects of, like, you know, in later movies where our main characters end up being very like professionals or very niche characters that do certain things, that comes from here. You know,
yeah, he's a thief. Like, honestly, though, right now, you saying that about James Caan doing the karate, I think of like Alec Baldwin's narration, and it'd be like, Mr. So-and-so Henry was a landscape guy, but he was also a thief. He also had a yellow belt in Taekwondo.
Exactly. Like Bryan Cranston at the beginning, right? That's what I mean, is that that's a character that he could re-put in another movie. In Isle of Dogs, this character could have been there, not as James Caan, as somebody else. And it's just, he would have just told you, like you said, the narration would have told the story instead of it being shown to you. Let's see if I can do it better.
It'd be like, okay, symmetrical shot, right? and it'd be like Mr. Whatever Henry, and he'd be like smoking a cigar, and he'd be like landscaper, and then it would show him out in the field, and then it'd be like yellow belt, show him part-time thief. Crook, yeah, and then like show him like a small action sequence of them like riding in the back of the van, lowering the mask, and then getting out like, everybody put your fucking hands up, like, and then it would just cut to back to him, you know,
exactly,
and like, and that's like, you know, I'm not trying to do Wes Anderson AI here, but I'm just saying when I see this, I'm like, oh fuck, that's the thing that you're gonna do, and like, you don't know that you're gonna do it, but I know because I've seen this already.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's really satisfying, I would say, this like this project, because to go back and see a filmmaker where you're like, wow, there it was from the beginning, and like, look, that's the thing that you're gonna do. I don't know if we really get that with some of the other guys we've done, because like I said, the Jordan Peeles, the Ari Asters, the Robert Eggers, these guys fucking fully baked right out of the oven, you know, and is like, oh shit.
Like what you're gonna get in what you were gonna get in Nope, as like, you know, people, I feel like heavily have dismissed that movie already for how good it is. The elements of the same things of him writing is still in Get Out. Mm-hmm. Those same themes and everything. So same thing here. It's like in Bottle Rocket, Wes Anderson trying to be the Wes Anderson we know now is in there. And same thing is like Nope is what probably Jordan Peele, the inside him being very cocky is what he's really venturing more and what he really wanted to make. He's becoming very proficient at being a storyteller. And all of these great directors, like you said, and a lot of them didn't come out with bangers, but they have the basis there. And it just, as somebody who admires film and, you know, masters at it, it is good to see certain ones that you're like, even though this is bad, I'm sure you watch Steven Spielberg's movie, there's still stuff there where you're like, The Thing. Like he did or it's like, you're going to do that in West Side Story again because people forgot because this movie sucks. You're going to do it again because you're like, no, it didn't. The movie just sucked. This trick or this narration or this way to go about the scene, like I'm going to figure it out, you know? So I'm sure there's a bunch of stuff in that movie that even though it was considered a bad movie that he ended up taking up somewhere. Similar here, James Caan's character, he's like later was like, wait a minute, I could probably use that in Asteroid City. You know how Hong Chau's character, somebody explained in 5 minutes and gone in the same five.
Yeah. So that for sure wraps it up this time. Like, subscribe, comment. Bottle Rocket is currently on Hulu. So if you got that, why not fire it up? Who doesn't have 90 minutes to watch a good to pretty good movie on a random Monday night, you know, or whatever night it is when you're listening to this. Like I said, like, subscribe, comment. Let us know your favorite Wes Anderson movie. Let us know if you watch Bottle Rocket. Let us know other filmmakers that you would be interested in seeing us, you know, talk about their filmography. Please try to keep it to somebody who has less than 15 films.
Someone like Sean Baker is cool.
Yeah, yeah. Give me like a 4 or 5 kind of guy. Some kind of current. yeah. So thank you for checking back in as always, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.